The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 24, 2023. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. Good to see you. I wasn't sure how many people we'd have here today on this holiday weekend, but I'm glad some of you could make it here. I just want to let you know that yesterday I spent the day, not the day, but took a little bit of time to read the book of Leviticus yesterday, which you might know is the third book in the Bible, in the Pentateuch, the first books of the Bible, the Torah, the law, the books of Moses. And very interesting, if you want to get into the law of the Bible, the Hebrew law, Leviticus is the place to look, because here we really have the laydown of the law. And I haven't read this book in any serious way for the last 60 years or so. I do remember wading through it as a teenager, or maybe I was 20, I don't know, somewhere back there. But I haven't gone back to that particular book. Genesis, yeah, a number of times, and other books of the Bible from time to time. But Leviticus, slow reading, though I kind of skimmed through, though I slowed down and read some parts again. But very interesting. And maybe it should concern us a little bit today. I'll say why in a minute here. But interesting stuff. God laying down the law, full of all kinds of sacrifices, slaughtering of animals and the burnt sacrifices, to offer these burnt sacrifices to the Lord. This produces an odor that is pleasing to the Lord. But it all has to be done in the right way, and the instructions are given in detail in Leviticus. All kinds of places where you would leave sacrifices, create sacrifices for God. And if you do things wrongly, what the punishments are, if you make some mistakes, just loaded with things like that. Also, what is clean and unclean. And unfortunately, the women seem to be more unclean than the men, but we're all unclean, pretty much. I mean, if a woman gives birth to a male child, she's unclean for 7 days. And then she has to go through all sorts, and no one can touch her. She can't touch anything, particularly anything holy, or that might be pleasing to God or whatever, until she purifies herself again, cleanses herself. And there's all kinds of rules for that. And if she gives birth to a female child, 7 days for a male child. If she gives birth to a female child, it's 14 days, or she's not clean and has to do all sorts. And there's things men do too, that where they have to cleanse themselves. And for it, but it goes on and on like this for pages. And then all the sacrificing. And in detail. That's why I started skimming, because to read that. But I was curious about what was in that book. I hadn't really looked at it seriously for so long. Yeah. And the reason I did that, you might wonder, well, why would I bother to look at it? And I didn't think I was going to be talking about this today, but I felt like I had to say something here. The reason that I got around to this is earlier this past week, we've had this incredible weather here. And the lake isn't even frozen, which here in Minnesota, I mean, that's Christmas Eve here, and that's unheard of. No snow, but very nice for getting out and taking a walk. So, and I usually try to get down to Lake Harriet every day and do some walking. And anyway, but as I was getting ready to go on my walk one day, I sometimes have a radio in the kitchen, and before I head out the kitchen door, I put on my shoes, whatever. I might just turn it on. There's a show on at that time. Maybe some of you know Tom Hartman. And sometimes at noon, or a little after noon, he'll have an interesting guest. So, and it was about that time, so I thought, well, just see if, in case he had anybody interesting on. And he did. And the fellow's name was, it was Frank Schumann, I think it was. And he had written a book some years ago, though apparently now it's, maybe people are looking at it or whatever, but it's called Crazy for God. Crazy for God. And he was born in Switzerland to hippie parents, I think he described it, or somebody did anyway, who had started kind of a commune there, but then they ended up moving to the U.S. I don't remember the detail or if he even gave much detail of that story, but here they were in the U.S., and he was being raised in this household, well, in this place where they had started this commune, or religious commune, or I don't know if that's the word I want, but a religious group. These are the people who became, this is the foundation of the so-called National Christian Movement or whatever. They're kind of the founders of it. Amy Coney Barrett, who is now sitting on our Supreme Court, was raised in this community. And it's not in any one place. They're all over the country now, apparently. Also, the name Amy Coney Barrett was given at the suggestion, given to the fellow who is now our current Speaker of the House, Mark Johnson, I believe, right? Who then passed it along and for her to be considered for the Supreme Court, of which now she is a justice upon this, sitting on the Supreme Court. But this is Mark Johnson, now a man who is two heartbeats away from the presidency right now as we sit here, who believes, according to this fellow who was talking with Tom there, is, he was pointing out that that Mark Johnson believes that the United States Constitution is a mistake and that we should be following God's law, much of which is laid out there in the book of Leviticus. That's why I thought, after that percolated in my mind for several days, I thought, you know, I'm going to just take a look at Leviticus just to refresh myself. A book written in at least the 8th, 9th century BCE, Iron Age, a period of time, I believe, and shows a lot of how people were thinking at that time and how much obeisance to God and all of these different rules and regulations and things. And slavery's good. Not only is slavery good, well, it's certainly tolerable, but it isn't that we just tolerate it. We actually should practice it according to these laws, apparently. But this is a man, and I feel okay to speak. Normally, I wouldn't speak about an individual person in a general way like this, certainly not. Except in this case, we're talking about with Amy Coney Barrett, and these are public figures. And to the extent that we still live in a democracy, they put themselves forward to be considered and looked at. And I think it's very important that we consider who these people are and what they think. I'm not trying to characterize it as good or bad or anything else along those lines, but this is what it is. And you can see that for yourself, for what it is. But I thought that this was something worth bringing up. I'd already heard rumors or things of this sort, but and hearing, the man that wrote this book, he was brought up, and his parents were founders of this particular movement or whatever it is. That's now nationwide here in the U.S. And they have very powerful people in their organizations that are pulling strings here and there and now even sitting in very high offices, who are following apparently these laws of God that were laid down millennia ago, thinking that the current laws that we have, our Constitution here in the U.S., is a mistake, and we should be following God's law. I think it's important for us to be aware of this, that there's this kind of a movement going on. I wasn't aware of it anywhere near as much as I am now after listening to what he had to say, that fellow. Schumann, I think, maybe his name. I shouldn't repeat that because I'm not sure if I got that right. Anyway, so that's why I looked in on reading those laws. And it was when I was going through that chapter of Leviticus yesterday, and I thought, you know, I think I'm going to have to say something about this today. And so that's why I brought it up. But I think of, not just our teachings. Here in Dogen, where he'll say, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding. You might say that not requiring much of the intellect to read Leviticus or whatever, to reason from that as a judge or whatever. Maybe not, but because we think of the intellect as somebody of high intellect and can think with sound reasoning and all of that. But it's actually, when Dogen is speaking of that, it's actually, he's talking about cease from spending too much time, not just with the intellect or in the intellectual realms, but to back away from our conceptualizing, where we can really create a world for ourselves in our minds and even in our societies as we interact with each other, if we're thinking along similar lines or clashing lines or whatever. But Dogen is saying to, you know, cease from this. Part of this is because the things that we'll construct in our rational or our conceptual models of the world or of ourselves or whatever, God and God's laws and all of this, well, this is very, very powerful within us. And it's easy for us then to believe, to take on these things, to accept these things. And maybe we'll reason about them or even argue about them, but we're still hanging on to this or that. We can fight over it and who's got the right set here and all of this, but we continue to remain caught up with the intellect, with the mind, the conceptualizing, the grasping of ideas and concepts in ways that are not at all healthy. I think of Socrates. Well, I remember years ago, a young man, a teenager I knew, who I think we were discussing knowledge or ways of knowledge or something like this. And I remember one time he just burst into the room where I was sitting, and he says, I know that I know, he said. And I thought, yeah, well, this is the teenager point of view. I thought of, and I actually drew out a cartoon panel of Lao Tzu, because I thought of Lao Tzu right away. I'll tell you what he says on the fourth frame here, but in the first frame I'm picturing Lao Tzu as a baby, so I just drew him out as a little baby with his beard, because the myth is, he's a mythical character really, that he was born, came from his mother's womb at the age of 65, and he already had a beard, you know. But I drew a little baby with a beard, but just the caption is Lao Tzu as a baby. Lao Tzu doesn't know that he doesn't know. And Lao Tzu as a teenager. Yeah. I know that I know. But what really interested me was the third frame was, here's Lao Tzu, middle age. Beard now is getting longer. And in the bookshelf, well, there's a shelf of books behind him, and one of them is Plato. Lao Tzu has been reading his Plato. And Lao Tzu, in this one, Lao Tzu knows that he doesn't know. That's Socrates. Consider the wisest. What was it? The Oracle at Delphi? Where was it? I don't know. So far back, I don't remember so well now. But pronounce him as the wisest of all men, because he knew that he did not know. something along those lines. But then we have Lao Tzu, who reportedly has said, Lao Tzu doesn't know that he knows. Very interesting take on that. Never mind the baby and teenager here. I was thinking of the teenager. Yeah, it's kind of like we feel, but this is how it goes with knowledge. You know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, something like that. You know, the Dunning-Kruger effect, where when we first start to acquire some knowledge, we know a little bit about a subject or whatever, and then we, in no time at all, we really inflate what we think we know. We think we know a lot. Whereas the expert, the person who has spent a lifetime studying whatever this subject might be, are less likely to feel that they really know. Well, of course, they know a lot, but like Socrates, you know, you get to a point where you know and you realize you know that you don't know. But what's going on with Lao Tzu when he says, I don't know that I know? I don't know if Lao Tzu, well, first of all, Lao Tzu I think is mythical. But what would that be, to not know that you know? This, I would say, might be characteristic of an awakened mind. But this knowing, what is this, that's not knowing and the knowing? What is this about? And what is knowing exactly? We confuse that term, knowing, with belief. So often, when we're caught up in the conceptual, in the intellectual, in the graspable, where we're creating models and forms, well, then we can easily get caught up in what we think is the truth or the correctness of this model, this way of doing things, or this way that things are, and things of this sort. But what Lao Tzu is understanding here, what he's realizing, is that with true knowing, you know, this is what he knows in the end, but he doesn't know this. Doesn't know in our ordinary sort of way, in the conceptual way, the graspable way. Because with awakening, what you know is, and it's no different than I've heard this in lay language, what can I say, in our culture, you know, that, and it's really correct, but there's a real trap in it, though, too. But I've heard this expression, you've probably heard it, that all models are wrong, but some are useful. Yes, that's pretty good. But we can easily lose track of that first part, that all models, all conceptual constructs, however you want to put that, they're wrong. But still, some are useful. And that's where utility lies, is in this realm of the conceptual, in the theorizing, and the grasping, and the modeling, and all of that. Some of these are very dangerous. Some are just plain silly or vacuous. They don't amount to anything. But there's some are very useful. And so that's fine. But it would be very helpful if we knew this, that whatever model it is we might be using is just that, that it's not truth, it's not reality in any ultimate sense. But under certain circumstances, it might be useful for some limited end, some particular issue you might be dealing with, or a problem you want to solve, or whatever it might be. But what's important here is that limiting factor that you yourself, you can't order this by law for everybody to follow, but for each of us, we need to come to realize that whatever it is that we're holding in our minds, as a model, an explanation, an understanding of what this is or what is going on, what reality is, what is good, what is, well, evil, if you have to look at it that way. Well, what is all, you know, we have to realize that however you might want to model this, build laws for it or whatever, even moral laws or anything else, or the laws of the Pentateuch, the laws of God expressed in Leviticus or whatever, models of various things. But they're all wrong. If you knew this, if you truly knew this, and this is what I would say that last frame is, but Lao Tzu doesn't know that he knows. He's not holding models. He doesn't have any knowledge there about what it is that is truly knowable and known. And I would say that what is truly knowable and known is known by you even now as you sit here, by all of us. We all know truth. We all know reality. It's what is being lived out. Our problem is that we frame up points of view. In doing this, now we have there's no way for us to even understand mind or consciousness, for example. We've just thrown those out the window right now. Well, we probably don't think so, and we might use these models and things to try to explore and find our way toward a model of consciousness or mind. And then we think we really know. Well, to a greater or lesser degree, the people who really study this probably have a better sense of there's a lot here we don't really know. But what very few of us come to realize is that you can't know ultimately through these means. You can know things in such a way that some things might be useful, helpful. A model you might want to work with, to hold with that, and to find out what is useful and helpful. Well, I would say it is that which is out of the whole, not out of clamoring to make one part better than or stronger than or over another. It's a kind of a point of view which isn't a point of view of wholeness, of totality. But again, this is what the awakened realize, what they see. And this is true knowledge. True knowledge is what is directly experienced. There's no way to build a model of it. But yet we'll go ahead and play with this, and we'll try to build things and to explain things to ourselves. For those of us who might take up this way of Dogen's, for example, Wangpo and others, Nagarjuna, yeah, we won't cease from intellectual understanding, intellectual grasping. We don't cease from that. I don't know that we have to cease from it entirely all the time everywhere, because again, some of these models might be useful and functional. But it is helpful if we know this. And again, things are helpful and useful and functional if we don't keep ripping everything apart, fighting with our neighbor, or trying to appease some sky god that we're afraid will do everything wrong, or destroy us or whatever, if we don't follow these rules. Just to pull back and look at what we're doing, and to realize, this is all enlightenment really is to realize delusion, to see what that is, that we might not get caught up in it. The way we get caught up with anything at all is through the grasping, the entanglement. That's through the thinking, the intellectualizing, the conceptualizing. Again, that's not bad or evil or, you know, we should never do that. No, it's impossible, I think, for us to, as human beings, to never do that. But it is important that we not lose sight of what it is that we're doing when we do that. And that at no point are we ever taking hold of truth, reality. We can see directly, we can know, we do know, that we cannot take hold of anything here in regards to truth, reality. But we don't need to, because it is already being lived out and directly. And so to the extent that we can quiet our minds and settle our minds so we're not racing away with our thoughts, our ideas, our constructs. Or, well, yeah, but shouldn't we go this way or do this or move in this direction? Finally see that for what it is. If you're working on some small limited project in some way, yeah, maybe that's fine. But when it comes to this matter of what is going on here, what is this? We need to just simply stop and pay attention to this. And most of all, to see our own racing, craving, grasping, frightened, or totally elated and gone crazy with that about one thing or another. See our minds as they are, the ordinary grasping mind, the knowing mind in the sense of knowing ideas, concepts. These are functions that many can be very functional and useful, yes. Many can be very hurtful and destructive as well. Yeah, but to see all of that and to maybe not go so far with any of it. Certainly not to the point where, I have it. This is the truth. This is God's law. And we must follow it. All through Leviticus, I was noticing there'd be all this elaborate detail of how to do this or do that or don't do this, whatever. And then it would be the phrase, I am the Lord your God. That's repeated over and over. That was more or less what it was. So after saying all this thing, I am the Lord your God. It's kind of like, that's it. Don't argue, you know. But that sort of stuff can only be set up in a world of ideas and concepts and theories and grasping this and grasping that and setting one thing off. This is better. That's best. That's all wrong. This is right. If we're seeing things in wholeness and totality, there isn't anything like this. If we're really onto the truth, nothing to say, nothing to grasp, nothing to hold over another, nothing to use to destroy another or to make them move to the back seat or whatever. None of this. So anyway, but this is... Something I felt like maybe I had to say it today. Last couple of several times I've spoken here on Sundays, I've been talking about knowledge in one way or another, knowing or not knowing. I thought maybe I was done with that, but I felt I had a few more things to do. Some of this connects to a class I'll be doing in February on consciousness and mind. Mind and consciousness ain't no brainer, but that's... Another issue, but it'll relate to some things I pointed out this morning. But maybe I've gone on long enough here. Do you have any questions or comments about anything I said here? I did say that. I felt I could talk about some political leaders, and because, again, in a democracy, this is what we need to know, or vote these people in or out or whatever. Of course, none of us here, I don't think, live in the district where the Speaker of the House is, but still, he is the Speaker of the House, and that has a great bearing on our lives in many ways. So I felt free to talk in that way, though I don't want to tell you how to vote or anything else like that. But I would like to invite you to just be careful now and look at things. Realize, get a sense of what is going on here. You know, there's all kinds of forces, political forces and forces of other sorts that can have a great bearing on our life and our society and our culture and our planet. No point in getting angry or frightened. Well, if we're angered or frightened, so be it. But it's a matter of just really seeing what needs to be done for you in this next moment. And then just take that step. In other words, to just really be awake to this. Most of all, watch your mind. Notice when you're getting caught with some kind of righteous idea. Or some other you know, it'll be a righteous idea in your mind, perhaps, but there's no way to establish that in the world without just creating nothing but trouble. So it's a matter of just seeing this and living accordingly. But again, I think I've said enough. I'm rattling on here, so. Any questions? Anyone out there in Zoom land?
Steve?
Yes?
Mainly, of course, what you're pointing to always is experience and not clinging to the intellect and the ego.
Mm-hmm.
But it strikes me more and more vividly how much, we are our egos. If we were deprived of our egos, we'd be completely lost, most of us. Like, what am I without my ego? And as you were speaking, I was thinking again about how many of the great Buddhist teachers had profound loss early in their lives.
So
many of the Buddhist teachers
had loss.
Profound experiential loss early in their lives.
Oh, yes, okay.
The Buddha lost his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Dogen lost his parents. I mean, these were traumas that, at my age now, I have to think were helpful in dislodging the fierceness of the ego.
Mm-hmm.
And not wishing any bad ill on anybody. I guess I've gotten to the point where, at least personally, I've only gotten anywhere in this practice because of something I wouldn't wish on anybody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in my case too, I think the same is true. Well, I lost my father when I was 6 years old, and in looking back on that, after I started getting some understanding through this practice here, in an odd sort of way, I realized that that had a lot to do with where I was at that time and where I am now, for that matter. That seems, in some ways, well, I feel like a lucky person in a way, even though it was something rather tragic and something I would have never wished on anyone else. How could you possibly wish that on anyone, to lose their father early? And I don't know what even to make of it. I don't make anything of it. But I have asked myself many times, is this really required? You know, and after 78 years, I don't know. I really don't know. I hope not. On the other hand, I also think that we have all probably have encountered things. Losing a parent early in life is a pretty startling thing, and it's almost out there in flashing lights, like this is a real tragedy for someone. But I think there's probably many other things that go on that maybe outwardly don't look quite so distinct, like, oh, boy, that was an event that must have really done something for you. I won't say anything about Norm's experience other than to say there was something that I finally learned about Norm that I would say outwardly wouldn't have been such a bright object, like, that's what made you the way you are now. And yet, in sinking into what I know about him now, I realize, that's just what it is. So what I'm saying here is that I think probably, perhaps all of us have had something in our lives that was very intense, powerful, and life-changing, really. And sometimes it's easy to just ignore that, and other times maybe you can't. And it's not, again, it's not something you'd wish on anyone, but there it is. But if there is something that really throws you for a loop, and it might seem unfair, or, you know, why me, all those kinds of things that might come with it, but just consider that for a moment. There might be something of, you know, great importance here for you. Yeah. Did you have something else, or Dean? Did you have something else?
No, I agree. You know, I had many 18-year-old students, and I always reminded myself, just because they're 18 doesn't mean they're not open.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're 78 or 72 or whatever.
Yeah.
Finally, you're open. I mean, 18-year-olds can be
absolutely
open as well.
But yeah.
I guess I'm pointing out the problem I've had for a long time, that when you point to experience, the antidote is experience. It's not some theory.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there are experiences that none of us would wish on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You came to think of your father's death as a kind of jewel in a way. But what a...
Strangely,
what a weird thing.
Yeah, exactly.
That is. Yeah. And I just feel like, you know, having been in this practice for decades, that if I don't keep focused on these profound experiences, it's like hitting my head on a concrete wall over and over again. I recently have really come to understand when we describe this practice as dying and reawakening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And what it isn't is something like figuring it out. Just letting go of this. And the awakening is to what has been here all along. But it's hard to see when we're caught up with ourselves and our own modeling, our own lives. You know, it's hard to see, because that'll seem real and solid, and it's got to be just that. And even though 5 years from now it'll be totally different, or if you look 5 years back, what was really capturing you then, it's gone now. But we don't notice that, because we just go from one to the next. And at some point we can realize, you don't need to do this. Enjoy what comes, if it's enjoyable, and if it's sorrowful, take that in as well. But here it is, it'll continuously offer something new in each moment. There's nothing you can do about it. So, but we can live with a great deal of freedom then. If we really, but we have to see it, we have to truly see it. Well, yeah. Anything else? Yeah.
A little further along in the Sutta of Zen, Dogen says, do not think good or bad. This is back to Leviticus.
Mm-hmm.
Do not administer pros and cons.
Yeah.
But good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
Like the sign over our door.
Yeah. Out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing. There's a field, I'll meet you there. Yeah. Mike?
Yes, Steve. Thank you for your talk. Can you say a little more about not knowing that you know?
Yes, well, I see. Well, that's not knowing. That's not having ideas and concepts about what it is that we know. With true knowing, just like with this is another way of talking about the two truths. There's the conceptual, the small t truth, you know, this sort of thing, the stuff that's very noticeable and that we can grasp. And then there's this other, that it's not a thing even, but it's true knowing. And it what is it? It's actually our immediate, direct perceptual experience, which we think, we use the language wrongly, I would say. But we all do so, except I try to fight it, I guess. I don't know. But I might say something like, we talk about perception, and we say, I perceive the cup. Well, in my mind, that's not what perception is. And there's, even with the eye, here, all of a sudden, here's I formed here, and I see. But this is a concept. I is a concept. Seeing, in this sense, is a concept. And the cup is a concept. And that's in the conceptual. That's in the intellectual, the graspable, the modelable, that we can make models of and this sort of thing, and abstract it in various ways. And And we spend all of our time there without realizing to the extent that we're caught in believing the realness of the object and the subject. Well, this is delusion. It's a matter of in seeing that and realizing that. But that's a different seeing. That's not seeing an object, but that's true knowing. So like in print, if I'm writing this, when I'm talking about seeing, objectless seeing, that's the same as knowing, which I guess I could would italicize as well, as opposed to I know there's a cup. Yeah, well, I believe there's a cup on this table. I can have thoughts like that. Yeah, but what's truly known is I can't really say there's a cup on that table, which isn't to say that you can say that there's not a cup on it. I'm not saying anything like that. But I know that that's not ultimately what's going on. There's a cup on this table that I can touch and make sound from. So this is a different kind of knowing. And it doesn't bear an object. It's not carrying an object. And it can't be contradicted, none of that. But it also can't be spoken. But what Lao Tzu's going on there with, when he's saying, I don't know, this is Taoism now, but I would say that what it is that he doesn't know, he's not forming ideas about what it is that he knows directly. And of course, it isn't him that knows. There isn't any knower, actually, of true knowledge. But it is possible to realize that, to experience that, to know, and to know that, but there's no you that's doing it, or receiving it, or whatever else you want to put there. And this is not only available to all of us, this is what's actually happening all the time. I mean, this is reality. It is of this nature. It is mind. I'll talk about this in my class on mind, a no-brainer. We get so confused about the brain, which is a thing, and it's material. And is it what the material world is going to produce, a brain, or I mean a mind? You can produce a brain, yeah. And the brain can look very active while certain cognitive things are occurring, conceptual things, whatever, consciousness is occurring. Yeah. So, does that mean that glob of material there is actually producing this? All sorts of problems with that assumption. But anyway, but I'll get into that in that class, actually. But I don't know, did I help you there, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Anything else? Yes?
You talked about how ideas or concepts are wrong, but then at the same time, some are useful.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about both the Bible and Leviticus and then this practice. And in your understanding, and maybe this is what you meant by you don't know, but is when talking about awakening or understanding, what is necessary? And is it possible to come to that completely on your own? Or is some of that outside necessary?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I wish I did. Actually, I don't, because then it would be conceptual. But that's a very good question. Yeah. I don't know that it needs to be answered. Where does this come from? When the understanding is there, it's here. And is there anything that one does to bring you to that point where all of a sudden we realize, I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. But it's a good question. But I would say this, if it's coming from a little voice that's talking to you, about, well, this is right, this is, no, this is delusion. That will be delusion. Why? Because there is a thing there, and there's me here hearing it. All of that is absent with the with true knowing. And it is experienced now. That's all happening now. It's not a matter of figuring this out. I wouldn't think about it, because it's not a matter of figuring. You don't need to read Leviticus. You don't need to read any of the Buddhist scripture either. None of it is written down in that, because it can't be written down. Whatever gets written down or spoken, that's not it. So why do we have so much Buddhist literature and teachings and things like this? Well, because the words can point. They can direct our attention to something that, you know, that we're not noticing yet. At least that's what the sense of what I'm trying to do when I'm called on to give a talk or something. I can't tell you. I wish I could. I can't even tell myself what happened. I don't know. But it is a matter of just pay very careful attention to what it is that you are grasping. And you can realize the kind of the clunkiness of it. There's something there, and now there's me here that's doing the grasping. I'm seeing it, I'm tasting it, I'm thinking it, feeling it, whatever it might be. But there's something going on like that. That's all fine, but there isn't anything about the object of that in that scene, or the subject, you know, myself in that scene, that's ultimately real. It's just, it appears like this. It's appearance. And that's about it. Because you won't get this in a book. You won't get it, even the talks I give here. It's not in the talk. Usually what I am trying to do with with this teaching is just direct your attention to something you need to notice. But it's not in anything I'm saying. Because it could be anything at all in your mind, something you just happen to be thinking now or feeling or something you might notice across the room here or whatever. I don't know what's going on in your mind right now, but it doesn't matter. What matters about this, if it has a taste or a flavor or a sound, a voice in your mind, whatever it might be, that is delusion. Plain and simple. Boom. And if we truly know this, and know it not as, oh yeah, okay, that's right. Yeah, Steve said it's delusion. Yeah, but that's still the conceptual. Or the Buddha would say that this is delusion. Yeah, but this is still conceptual. It's a matter of just seeing what is directly there, with no voice, no distance. Well, where is the realization? Is it out there somewhere? Is it in my brain? Because we have now all this idea about consciousness being in the brain, stuff like this. So we think that way. We'll point to our heads. All of this is really kind of just silly, in a sense. Though I can't say it's silly, because so many of us deeply believe this. But it's just a matter of noticing what's taking place. Okay, well, is there anything else? Okay, we have used up the hour here, so thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.